From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the new HBO series 6 Feet Under with its creator, Alan Ball. The series is about a family that runs a funeral home and has to live in the constant presence of death. Ball won an Academy Award for his screenplay for the film American Beauty. He got his start writing for TV sitcoms like Grace Under Fire and Sybil. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by singer-songwriter Rufus Wainwright. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. African leaders at the UN's first international summit on AIDS today asked nations around the world for more help in combating AIDS on their continent. Secretary General Colin Powell said the U.S. plans to increase its commitment.
I am proud to say that my government has been and will continue to be the largest bilateral donor in the fight against AIDS, providing 50% of all international funding.
A UN AIDS fund now has grown to about $530 million, including a $2 million pledge from Uganda. Secretary General Kofi Annan has said an extra $7 to $10 billion a year is needed to effectively fight AIDS in the developing world. The Supreme Court today ruled the FBI may temporarily retain information about gun buyers after instant background checks. It rejected the National Rifle Association's contention that temporarily keeping the information is illegal. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The NRA was challenging the way the FBI deals with information gathered during so-called instant background checks in gun stores. These on-the-spot checks replaced 5-day waiting periods under the Brady Act in 1998. Attorneys for the NRA claim that the FBI's practice of keeping demographic information about legal gun buyers on file for several months amounts to a national registry of gun owners and is illegal under the Brady Law. The FBI currently keeps such records about 3 months to audit the system and to make sure only authorized checks are run. An appeals panel found that nothing in the Brady Act prohibits temporary retention of gun buyer information. The Supreme Court, without comment, upheld the appeals court ruling. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the United States last week received information suggesting a likely threat against U.S. forces in the Middle East. It was that information, he says, that prompted commanders in the region to put their troops on security alert. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
Rumsfeld's comments came in an interview with NPR on the 5th anniversary of an attack on U.S. troops at the Khobar Towers facility in Saudi Arabia. Rumsfeld said U.S. intelligence agencies often get scraps of information hinting of possible terrorist threats. You can't constantly be reacting to that, he said.
On the other hand, if you have a little bit more than scraps of information that suggest the likelihood of a threat, then you have to take the obvious precautions. And what happened in this instance was that there was sufficient information that the appropriate decisions makers decided that they should take certain number of steps.
U.S. forces throughout the Middle East have been on maximum alert for 4 days now. U.S. ships have moved out to sea, and U.S. troops have cut short training exercises. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
The Dow Industrials closed down 100 points today. The Nasdaq was up 16. This is NPR News. Peru's president-elect said today in New York he will not intervene in the case of Lori Berenson, an American woman sentenced to 20 years in prison for collaborating with terrorists in Peru. Alejandro Toledo made his decision over pleas from Berenson's parents to consider a pardon. Toledo told reporters he's respectful of the independence of the judicial system in Peru. During his controversial visit to Ukraine, Pope John Paul II today prayed at the Baba Yar Memorial in Kiev. This is the site of the massacre of thousands of Jews during World War II. NPR's Mike Schuster has the details.
John Paul has referred to the horrors of Baba Yar several times during his trip to Ukraine, noting the massacre that occurred there in 1941 after the German army invaded the Soviet Union. Today, after his second outdoor mass in 2 days, the Pope stopped at Baba Yar to pay personal tribute to those who died there. More than 30,000 Jews from Kiev were systematically murdered and their bodies dumped at a ravine at Baba Yar. Thousands more Ukrainians were also killed and buried there. The Soviet government erected a monument to the dead in the 1960s, but made no specific mention of the murdered Jews. John Paul has made a special effort to correct the Vatican's failure to speak out against the Holocaust during the war and afterward. At Babi Yar, the Pope bowed his head, recited a Latin prayer for the dead, then turned to Kiev's chief rabbi and said, "God bless you." Mike Schuster, NPR News, Kiev.
Fog today interfered with attempts to help a North Atlantic right whale entangled in a fishing rope off Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Scientists had planned surgery to remove the plastic line from the whale's infected jaw, but the fog made it impossible for a plane to find the location of the whale. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Ball, is the creator of the new HBO series 6 Feet Under. He won an Oscar for his screenplay for American Beauty. He was a playwright before he got his start writing in TV for the sitcoms Grace Under Fire and Sybil. 6 Feet Under follows the Fisher family, which owns and runs a funeral home. Each episode opens with the death of someone whose funeral will be handled by the Fisher family. On the first episode, which was shown 4 weeks ago, it was the father, Nathaniel Fisher, who was killed in a collision with a bus while driving his hearse. His wife is breaking down. His son David, who has already been working in the business, plans to take it over. David's sister Claire is still in high school. His older brother Nate moved away years ago, trying to distance himself from the family business. After their father's death, Nate's first impulse is to convince the family to sell the business to the corporation that is trying to buy them out. But then he reconsiders. In the kitchen with his family, he tells David he wants to keep the business and become a partner. David's sarcastic response will give you a sense of the family dynamic.
So now you don't want to sell?
I know it sounds crazy.
Oh, no, not at all. We'll keep the business for the rest of the day, then sell it again tomorrow for a few hours.
Just hear me out.
No, this is a good system. We'll sell in the mornings, keep it in the afternoons, and maybe sometimes we sell again in the evenings when we really can't make a decision.
David, you're not being fair.
When I didn't want to sell, you could have cared less. When Nate doesn't want to sell, you listen.
Okay, I'm the terrible mother who's responsible for all your problems. Happy?
Alan Ball, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
How would you describe 6 Feet Under to someone who hasn't yet seen it?
Well, our log line on the set is Knott's Landing in a funeral home. It's kind of it's sort of an existential soap opera. It's a show about a family that runs a funeral home, and as such, you know, death is their business, and they're surrounded by it. But it's not a show about death. It's about life in the face of death, and you know, people who, because of their chosen profession, you know, are surrounded by death and how that affects their outlook on life.
Now, the idea of setting a show in the funeral industry was proposed to you by an HBO executive. What was the original proposal and what did you see in it?
Well, I had lunch with Carolyn Strauss, who is the head of HBO original programming, a few weeks after American Beauty was released. And she said, "I've always wanted to do a comedy about a family-run funeral home." And something in my head just went, wow, that's really interesting. That's something I've never seen. That's spiritual and dark and weird, and I'd love to work on that. However, at the time when I was having lunch with her, I was doing this show, this sitcom for ABC called Oh Grow Up, but it got canceled relatively soon after, and I just sort of wrote the pilot for 6 Feet Under without even pitching it to her, without pitching the characters, without pitching. And I wrote it as an hour show as opposed to a half hour, which is what I think she was originally looking for. And I sort of did it as a preemptive strike just to avoid having to go back into network sitcom land, because I felt like I'd spent my time in that particular gulag and I didn't really want to go back.
Was the pilot that you wrote the pilot that was actually broadcast a few weeks ago?
Yeah, well, I wrote the pilot. I took it in to HBO, and we had a meeting, and they said, it feels a little safe. It feels a little network. Could you make the whole thing just a little more screwed up? Well, I had never gotten a note like that in TV.
Right.
And I just sort of, you know, looked up at the ceiling and said, thank you, God. And I said, yeah, I can definitely screw it up. And I didn't go in and screw things up just for the sake of that. But, it, you know, when they said that to me, I sort of felt like I had carte blanche to really go into the nooks and crannies of these characters' psyches. And then it got really interesting.
Can you give us an example of something that was less screwed up initially that got more screwed up after you got that suggestion?
Well, in the pilot, you know, Nate meets Brenda at the airport and they have sex.
Just for people who aren't following the series, Nate is the brother. Okay,
he's the prodigal son. He's the oldest son,
right,
who left home because he did not want to go into the business.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been sort of a Peter Pan, you know, hippie, basically. And he comes home for the Christmas holidays, and his father's killed in a car accident on the way to the airport to pick him up. But in the pilot, he meets this woman on the plane, Brenda, and she's kind of very, very sexually assertive, and they end up having sex in a broom closet. And then in my original draft, she just was kind of really nice, and then she showed up at the funeral and said, you know, after Nate has this scene where he sort of insists on picking up the dirt actually with his bare hands and throwing it into the grave, as opposed to a more sanitized procedure that's standard for the funeral home. And she sees that and she sort of goes, wow, you know, that was really impressive. So she was just basically kind of like the nice girlfriend, you know. And so I went back and I made her a little more brittle and a little more mysterious, and put in a phone call where, you know, she calls him and, you know, just to check out how he's doing. And he sort of flirts with her and says something along the lines of, you know, he sort of like calls her on some of her stuff, and she just snaps and says to him, you think you're not easy to read? You know, guys like you are good for, you know, a roll in the hay, and that's it. And she hangs up the phone. It just sort of makes it more complicated.
Why don't we play back that phone call that you just described?
Hello?
Well, it's about to start raining frogs here. How are things on your end?
God, I'm glad you called.
Really? Why?
I don't know. Because you, you have a calming effect on me?
Uh-huh. Are you familiar with the psychological term projection?
Oh, are you familiar with the psychological term below me? Come on. You grew up with all that psychobabble. Rebelled against it every chance you got, still do. And that includes having sex with strangers in closets at airports.
And you think you're not easy to read? Coasting by on your looks and charm isn't working like it used to, but you have no idea what else to do because you've never had to learn. Any woman with half a brain looks at a guy like you and thinks, good for a hot but believe me, that's it.
Alan Ball, I'm glad you brought up the character of Nate's girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some ways, I still don't know what to make of her. I don't know whether she's a kind of really smart person, a life force, or whether she's really troubled, whether she's beneath all of this, a really troubled person who's going to do a lot of damage as the series plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to be confused?
At this point, yeah. A lot about Brenda gets explained over the course of the first season. A lot of why she is the way she is explained, and you understand where she comes from. And she's also, underneath that, she's incredibly vulnerable, much more than she would even like to admit to herself. And we eventually get to that place. But what was interesting to me about Nate and Brenda, as opposed to, you know, the traditional, they're kind of like the Hope and Michael from 30-something of our show. But the traditional sort of main couple of a show is usually very well-adjusted and very, you know, committed and very good about expressing their feelings. And these are two people who don't have any experience in a long-term relationship for their own reasons. And they're both smart and they're both good people, but they don't necessarily have the skills to maintain a relationship. But they're both at points in their lives where they kind of want to do that. And I also think, you know, in my mind, overlooking the entire course of the series, there's a little bit of fate involved in the two of them being together.
Now, I find that I usually resist new series until after a couple of episodes or more, the characters finally get under my skin, and I get really interested in them. I think I have a very crowded brain that feels already overpopulated with characters and plot lines.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think of yourself as having to fight against that when you're writing a pilot? Because in the pilot, you have to do a lot of work. You have to not only make it interesting, but you have to introduce a whole cast of characters, introduce the basic plot of the series, and keep resistant people like me interested.
One of the great things about working at HBO as opposed to working at the broadcast networks, just based on my own limited experience with the broadcast networks, is that HBO is constantly encouraging me to really get into the character psyches and get into the stuff that's not so pretty, the warts, the neuroses. And as a writer, I've always been drawn to those characters because, well, number one, I can relate to them more than I can relate to, like, the perfect heroes or heroines. And number two, my heart goes out to them. I love characters who are trying to make sense of their lives and trying to live an authentic life in an increasingly inauthentic world, but they're not totally equipped and they're just kind of acting on blind faith and, you know, really, you know, making mistakes and their lives are messy. I find that much more poignant and much more captivating than, you know, your totally perfect hero or your completely nurturing, you know, wife, mother, heroine, that kind of thing. I just don't, those archetypes don't interest me. And plot actually doesn't interest me as much as character. And so in the pilot of 6 Feet Under, I felt like, you know, there's nothing like a death, a cataclysmic event to really bring, it just sort of peels away a layer of skin. And you get to see how people really are underneath the armor that they wear through daily life and the masks that they wear through daily life. And those are the moments to me that are always interesting. And I just, you know, 6 Feet Under is the first television project that I've worked on that is something that I myself would actually watch. And so when I wrote it, it was from a very instinctive place as opposed to, well, I need to convey this information about this person and blah, 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 blah. And usually pilots I've worked on before, there's so much studio involvement, there's so much network involvement, and you're constantly being told to spoon feed information about the characters to the audience, whereas at HBO it was just like, just let the behavior speak for itself.
You'd written for several shows for commercial TV, and in commercial TV, a program is divided into acts with commercials separating one act from another. Are you basically taught when you start working in network TV how to plot around the commercials?
Yeah. You start when we were breaking stories for half-hour sitcoms, we would start with the act break. Well, actually, we would start with the moment where, you know, the moment at the end where people get all weepy and somebody learns a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I worked on those kind of shows. and then you'd figure out the act break.
So what are the tricks that you're supposed to keep in mind when you're writing into or getting out of a commercial?
Well, you want to end the act with something that is a bit of a cliffhanger so that people will wait, you know, will sit through the commercials and they won't change the channel. Other tricks, you know, we just, I don't know, the shows I worked on had, and a lot of American sitcoms do have this, I feel, they have kind of a leering adolescent viewpoint about sexuality. And the characters may be teenagers or they may be middle-aged, but it's this sort of like bedroom farce, wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of viewpoint that is, you know, after a certain point, after you reach a certain point in life, it's like, well, grow up. It's not that big a deal.
My guest is Alan Ball, creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Ball, creator of the new HBO series 6 Feet Under, about a family that runs a funeral home. Now, I'll tell you something surprised me. At the end of the latest episode, episode 4, several people at the end of the show actually seem to learn a lesson and grow. You know, a gang leader learns to have empathy with his dead homie's parents. The daughter seems to learn she probably doesn't want to flirt with gangs and guns. And David, the brother who's been in the business for a while, kind of learns a lesson from the corpse. I should say here that the corpse usually talks to
Well, David's the guy who spends
people in the funeral home.
Yeah, he spends a lot of his time with dead people, you know. And that, of course, is not meant I'm not implying that these people are actually ghosts. These are manifestations of interior dialogues that he's having with himself.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I think as you watch the series, people do learn lessons and then they backtrack. You know, it's one step forward, two steps back. But you know, while I feel like a lot of the lesson learned moments in network TV seem to me very saccharine and very superficial, I don't think that one should necessarily just try to avoid those moments altogether, because we do learn lessons in life. But what we attempt to do is for it to be tempered, for it to be realistic. But people have profound moments in their lives. And in a show that is about how the constant presence of death throws your own life into stark relief, I think people will have profound moments. Are you familiar with the writer Thomas Lynch?
Yeah, the poet who's also an undertaker.
Yeah, well, you know, I did a lot of research when I started working on the show, and his books had the most profound effect on me just in terms of the tone of how they were written. And there's a certain reverence for life, but at the same time, just a completely unsentimental acceptance of the fact that it is fleeting. And so I think that's what I'm attempting to do in the moments where people, you know, people do learn things. People do become aware of things. People's consciousnesses expand. But at the same time, it's a constant struggle, because you always, you know, you always want to fall back.
Alan Ball is my guest. He's the creator of the new HBO series 6 Feet Under, and it's about a family that runs a funeral parlor. You know, you described the series about living in the constant presence of death, and I know that death really entered your life. I'm not sure if it was for the first time or not, when you were 13, and your sister was killed in a car accident. You were both in the car at the time she was driving. Could I ask you to tell what happened?
Well, my life was very clearly separated into before and after at that moment. She was driving me to a music lesson, and it was her 22nd birthday, and she pulled out in front of a car and it hit the driver's side and she was killed instantly, and I was not hurt at all. It was profoundly shocking and traumatic moment in my life, and you know, I will carry deep scars from that moment until the day I die. And then there was a lot of blood, and in the ambulance I said, "Is she going to be okay?" And instead of just telling me, "No, she's dead," they said, yes, she's going to be okay. They took me to the hospital, and I was I was thinking, well, she's going to be okay, she's going to be okay. I was holding on to that, and then our family doctor came and picked me up and was driving me back to meet my parents. And he said, "You're going to have to be strong for your parents." And I said, "Well, why? You know, she's going to be okay, isn't she?" And he said, "No." And there was a moment where a very distinct physical sensation of just the bottom dropping out from under me at that moment. And my family, I wouldn't call them dysfunctional, because there was no abuse or no addictions or anything like that. But certainly we were not particularly skilled in intimacy. And what happened is that everybody sort of splintered and went into their own little world. And I think that's certainly, there is a dynamic of that in the Fishers, in that people really kind of, even though they're a family and they share the same house, they exist separate as separate entities. And that, to me, is what gives the show fertile ground, because as these people move towards each other and start to reach out to each other, that's, I think, where you can really mine that for some great drama and some great comedy.
You said that in your family, when your sister died, that everyone in the family withdrew into their own world. What world did you withdraw into, and did you remember that when you were writing the characters for Six Feet Under?
What I did is I became incredibly active at school. I became like the guy who did everything. Any club I could join, any organization, anything I could do to get out of the house, I would do it. So I became somewhat of an overachiever. And no, there's not really that dynamic in Six Feet Under.
The daughter doesn't seem to be on the verge of becoming an overachiever.
No,
I'll
she doesn't. no, actually, I think, you know, it wasn't until I went away to college. I was very much a very, like, I actually was, in high school, I was named, like, Young American, which was this group of kids that
were supposed... Oh, little did they know.
Exactly. They were supposedly very upstanding and, you know, everything that was great about America, whatever. And then I was actively trying to do that. I was trying to be, you know, the ideal of what you're supposed to be. And it really had very little to do with who I actually was.
Alan Ball is the creator of the new HBO series, 6 Feet Under. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Alan Ball, creator of the new HBO series 6 Feet Under, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Rufus Wainwright. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alan Ball, the creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. Ball won an Oscar for writing the film American Beauty. Six Feet Under is about a family that owns a funeral home and lives in the constant presence of death. Ball's sister died in a car crash when he was 13. What was your sister's funeral like?
It was surreal. It was very surreal. It was, you know, the traditional open casket thing. And I remember the first time I saw her in the open casket, I thought, okay, who's that? Because they had done her completely different. They'd given her, like, big, boofy hair, which she never wore in life. It was like a lipstick color that she would never wear. And I'm sorry, you know, when they lay those bodies out in caskets, they look phony. They look like wax figures. And it's certainly for me, and that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that this is true for everybody. It was not at all comforting to see that. And there was a point where my mom just broke down and started to cry, and somebody from the funeral home just appeared out of nowhere and silently swooped her off into this room and shut the drape. And that moment is very, I put that moment in the pilot because I'll never forget that, because the subtext of that moment is, oh, these emotions are, it's, they're, no, you shouldn't see this. This is bad. You shouldn't have this kind of emotion. The way that we should deal with this is very quiet, very muffled. Keep everything down. Well, no, that's a lie, because what you need to do is you need to scream, you need to bang on the wall, you need to, like, tear at your hair. Because grief is a primal, primal thing, and the only way out of it is through it. And, you know, it took me 25 years to learn that, because I never really grieved for my sister, because, number one, I was told to stay strong for my parents. Number two, I just didn't have the skills. I didn't know what you were supposed to feel, how you were supposed to express it. It was too overwhelming. It was too terrifying. And so I carried that grief, that unexpressed grief, around for 20 years. And then when I was living in New York, I'd been pursuing this career as a writer, you know, doggedly my entire life. And I wrote this play that got optioned by Columbia Pictures, and they gave me, for what was for me at that time, a large amount of money, and I quit my day job. That was a thing I had been working for, you know, my entire life, the moment when I could quit my day job and I could be a writer full time. And what happened is I went into this pretty severe depression, because now that I no longer had this goal to distract me, all of that, those years of repressed grief welled up, and I had, you know, pretty standard post-traumatic stress syndrome. I had panic attacks. My heart was racing all day long. I couldn't sleep. I would burst into tears at the drop of the hat. You know, luckily I was living in New York City, so nobody really cares. You can just sit there on the subway and start weeping copiously, and nobody
really
pays
true.
Any attention.
Yeah.
And I thought that I was losing my mind. I thought, I'm going insane. And it was a period that lasted for about 6 or 7 months, and it was one of the darkest, most painful periods of my life. And having come out on the other side, I'm so glad I went through it, because it really deepened me. It really made me kind of a stronger and a richer human being, having experienced, really allowing myself to feel the primal existential pain of a loss of that magnitude.
Who was it who made you think that this depression and panic you were going through had to do with your sister's death 20 years ago? Did you come to that conclusion yourself?
Well,
was
I was in therapy.
Therapy? Uh-huh.
I was in therapy. Mm-hmm. And I had some dreams that sort of, like, keyed me into it.
Right, right.
I have a very active subconscious. Sometimes it's
right.
Very unsubtle. It's just like, okay, this is what this is about. You need to pay attention to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought maybe I could play a scene here. You know, you're talking about the importance of grief, and how, like, at your sister's funeral, the funeral director tried to cover that up by escorting mm-hmm. your grieving mother behind behind a curtain. There's a scene I want to play from the end of an episode, because it's the first episode. In which the father's being buried, and the one of the sons, the prodigal son who's come back, wants to throw fistfuls of dirt onto the coffin, as opposed to, as you describe it, the more sanitized, symbolic version of throwing dirt onto the coffin, mm-hmm. which is what this funeral home usually practices. And his brother, who has been in the funeral business for a while, gets really angry with him for acting out like mm-hmm. that, and for showing his anger mm-hmm. and grief in public. And this is the conversation they have between them about what the appropriate way to behave is.
You want to be the alpha dog, Nate? Is that it? Coasting toward midlife with nothing to show for it. Now you want to come back and be the rock for this family to lean on? F*** you.
That is not what I'm...
You want to get your hands dirty? You sanctimonious prick, talk to me when you've had to stuff formaldehyde-soaked cotton up your father's ass so he doesn't leak.
Jesus.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you just would have tossed him out with the garbage. It may seem weird to you, but there is a reason behind everything that we do here. We provide people with a very important and sacred service at the darkest time in their lives, because maybe they don't want to make a spectacle of themselves, because maybe they prefer to grieve in private.
Why? Why does it have to be such a secret? It's nothing to be ashamed of. Dave, please.
God, you know nothing. Nothing. You had a responsibility to this family, and you ran away from it, and you left it all for me.
Whoa, don't blame me if you're not living the life you want. That is nobody's fault but your own.
Okay. Fine, just do me a favor, okay? You got out. Stay out.
Is there anything you want to say about writing that scene, Alan Ball?
I think there's, because I think they both have valid viewpoints. I don't think Nate is the hero and David is the villain at all, because Nate is so self-righteous when he's telling David, you can't go through this without getting your hands dirty. He's telling this to a man who constantly, you know, who constantly prepares dead bodies. And that's what Nate was afraid of and Nate ran away from. And in David's mind, of course, he abdicated his responsibility and left David with no choice but to go into this business. I also think the thing about the relationship between Nate and David is that the bedrock of that relationship is just this fierce love for each other. But because of the various ways that their lives have taken them, they can't communicate that. And so that passion gets rechanneled into anger and resentment.
My guest is Alan Ball, creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Ball, creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. You had to learn something about what restorers do when they're working with the corpse, especially if the corpse, you know, if the person died in a terrible
yes.
accident that mutilated
yes.
the body in any way. Where did you go to learn about that, and what are some of the things that you learned that you're drawing on now?
Well, I actually, you know, I did some reading. I checked out some textbooks from, you know, restorative arts textbooks from, you know, funeral training institutions, embalming textbooks I looked at. But we have consultants on the show, people who are licensed embalmers, who are licensed funeral directors, that we sort of turn to mm-hmm. when we need to be really specific about what's going on. But I did learn all kinds of stuff. You know, I never knew really what happened in an autopsy. I didn't realize that they remove most of your organs, you know. Because when you embalm somebody after an autopsy, the circulatory system is not intact. So you have to do it limb by limb. It's an entire world of stuff that most people don't want to know about and thankfully never need to know. But I can tell you this. I've decided that when I die, I'm going, it's straight cremation for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I don't really understand the need to preserve the body.
You know what I find disturbing? The sense that after someone you love dies, that they still have an address. And the address is the cemetery.
Yes.
And that's where you're supposed to go visit them. And that's that there's a place where you're supposed to be thinking about them, that it's not enough to carry them in your heart and in your memory. There's an address that they have, and you're supposed to go there on certain holidays. And it could be an incredibly alienating experience because you're not necessarily going to feel their presence anymore in that cemetery than you are sitting in your bedroom or your living room.
No. Last time I went home, I went to the cemetery because my sister and my father are both buried there. And I hadn't been in years, and I thought, well, I'll just drive by and stop. And just being there is such a, it is for me an alienating experience. It's so weird, and I didn't feel, you know, I cried, but it wasn't because I felt particularly close to them or I felt their presence. I feel their presence much more throughout daily life.
Why do you think you cried then?
Maybe it's because, you know, Brenda says in one of the episodes of 6 Feet Under, you know, things happen that leave a mark in space, in time, in us. And maybe just being in that particular spot, there's a mark, there's some sort of psychic mark for me that reminds me of you know, those moments when it happened. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel the presence of either one of them, my sister or my dad. I just felt sad. But it was sort of a weird kind of generic sadness.
So you're going to go the cremation route. Have you told people that? I mean, have you made it official that that's what you want?
Yeah.
And yeah. Do you want to be scattered or kept in an urn?
You know what? I don't really care what happens to me after right. I'm dead. I'm dead. I try to, I mean, one of the things that's weird karma for me is, you know, I have my own fear and loathing of death, just like Nate, that I carried with me for years. And, you know, everybody has that, and we all will have it until we go. But now that I'm writing about death and kind of confronting death, at least hypothetically, on a regular basis, there's a certain relaxation and a certain kind of liberation. And Thomas Lynch says the dead don't care. And I don't think they do.
But if you don't care what happens, why are you so certain about cremation? Is it to spare other people having to be tied to this address of the cemetery or to this responsibility to visit it?
I mean, to take a body and pump it full of all these chemicals and preserve it, and then there's something incredibly wasteful to me about that. And I think, you know, why just recycle me? Just, you know. There's a great David Sedaris short story where he has his cat cremated, and then because she never particularly expressed any interest in the outdoors, he sprinkles her ashes on his carpet, and then he vacuums them up, which I love.
and David's a wizard with a vacuum cleaner. Oh, well, you know, I'm wondering, though, if there have been any of the, like, rituals surrounding death that gave you a surprising amount of comfort or that did nothing for you, you know?
When my dad died and when my sister died, the rituals did nothing for me, mm-hmm. nothing. Mm-hmm. And we were not a particularly religious family. We were Methodists. I was raised Methodist, and we went to church on Easter and on Christmas. And then when my sister died, suddenly it became all about religion. And my mom and my dad both, bless their hearts, they were just trying to find some place to turn to offer them any solace in their grief, became very, very focused on that whole sort of, you know, end of the world gothic Christianity about the rapture and all that stuff. And I would come home from school. I was 13 years old. My entire life was ahead of me. And I'd come home from school and find my mom, like, crying. And I'd say, you know, what's wrong? And she would say, well, you know, another prophecy has come true. We're that much closer to the end times. And she sort of looked at that as a good thing, because her life was so painful at that point that I think she just wanted an excuse to, you know, I don't think she ever contemplated suicide seriously, but I think she would have welcomed, you know, some big cataclysmic apocalyptic event that would just take her out of her misery. Now, I was 13. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I was being told, you know, we're closer to the end of the world, and that's a good thing. And so I sort of went, okay, thanks. Thanks, Mom. Yeah.
Right. I want to briefly change the subject from death, the funeral business, and your series 6 Feet Under to pornography. And the reason why, I read, I think it was in The New Yorker, that you know how a lot of pornography is a pun on a well-known mainstream film?
Well, yes.
Your film, American Beauty, has had its porn parallel, which is American Booty.
American Booty.
So have you rented the film?
Actually, I didn't even know it existed, and a very good friend of mine sent me a copy. And it's great because the cover, the video cover, is it's like a total ripoff of the poster. It's it's a background of rose petals. The typeface is exactly the same, and it's a woman's buttocks, and she's holding a rose between them. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, this is the most exciting thing. You know, I have created something that has now been bastardized by a porno knockoff. Wow, I have arrived. I did watch it.
Are any of the scenes homages to your film?
Not really. There's it starts off with this kind of vague montage of suburban houses. They all look like houses in the San Fernando Valley. And then this woman just sort of looks at the camera, and you can tell she's kind of coked up. It's really sort of seedy and sordid. And she has this monologue. She goes, "This is my neighborhood. It's so boring. If something exciting doesn't happen soon, I'm just going to jump out of my skin." And then they dump rose petals behind her, but it's not in slow motion, so it looks just like garbage is falling. And then the next thing you know, you're in a jail, and some completely different woman is having sex with two men.
Well, congratulations, you have arrived.
Yes.
Well, I want to leave you with the words printed on the stationery. It's the motto of a tombstone and memorial company in this area, and it's, "We won't take you for granted." Well, Alan Ball, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry. It was such a pleasure.
Alan Ball is the creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Rufus Wainwright's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Rufus Wainwright is the son of two semi-famous musicians, Loudon Wainwright and Kate McGarrigle. Both parents began their musical careers with much acclaim, but achieved little commercial success. Their son Rufus, still in his 20s, has just put out his second album, which is called Poses. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's a less folk-oriented, more commercial-sounding CD than anything Loudon or Kate ever made, but Ken wonders whether Rufus is in for the same long haul as his parents. Thank you.
cigarettes and chocolate milk. These are just a couple of my cravings. Everything it seems I like's a little bit stronger, a little bit thicker, a little bit harmful for me if I should buy jelly beans.
When Loudon Wainwright started out his career in the early 70s, he was stickered with the label of being a new Bob Dylan. When Kate McGarrigle began recording with her sister Anna around the same time, they made beautifully crafted but small-scale works that never sought a large audience. Rufus Wainwright has inherited a lot. His own sticker, his is Out Gay Artist, and a rebellious reaction to his mom's career. Unlike her, he wants to be a big star. He's also inherited his parents' gift for meticulous craft, impeccably measured wordplay, a knack for lovely melodies, but he works on a grander scale with, there's no doubt, a grander audience in mind.
California, California, you're such a wonder that I think I'll stay in bed. Big time rollers, part time models, so much to plunder that I think I'll sleep instead. I don't know this. Seeing neon, thousand suckers with Cipriol and big nights back east with Rhoda.
Wainwright calls his new CD Poses, and it's a collection of them. In various tunes, he's a dandy, a depressed cynic, a jaded adventurer, or as the song title puts it, a rebel prince. Wainwright revels in self-absorption, preening his homosexuality much more prominently than he did on his debut, in compositions here such as Greek Song and The Consort. It's with heavy irony, however, that his gay venturesomeness comes across most effectively in a cover of a song by his dad, himself a sometimes obnoxiously straight artist, called One Man Guy.
People know when they see this show the kind of a guy I am. They'll recognize just what I stand for and what I just can't stand. They'll perceive what I believe in, and what I know is true. And they'll recognize I'm a one-man guy with words through and through. People meditate, that's just great, trying to find the inner you. People depend on family and friends and other folks to pull them through. I don't know why I'm a one-man guy, why I'm a one-man show. But these 3 cubic feet of bone and blood and meat are all I love and I'm a one-man guy.
When Rufus sings that song, he sounds lonely and wistful, as though being a one-man guy is a pose he wishes were real. It's an anomaly on this collection, however, which is overloaded with piano-based, elaborately orchestrated Rococo arrangements that render his voice a blur of sadness and longing. I suspect that Rufus's sexuality will end up pigeonholing him as inescapably as his father's novelty song wise guy persona did him. Rufus's contemporaries don't give a hoot about his parentage, of course, but this 27-year-old singer-songwriter's self-knowledge hangs heavily over him. like every progeny of musician parents, from Sean Ono Lennon to Jacob Dylan, he has yet to break entirely free of the limits he imposes upon himself, consciously or unconsciously, to achieve the original sound he so clearly craves. Gay artists have for many years used the notion of the pose, ironic distance, to communicate heartfelt emotion. About half the time on poses, Rufus Wainwright achieves this very satisfyingly. The rest of the time, he's just posing.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Poses by Rufus Wainwright.
Yellow walls are lined with portraits, and I got my new red fetching leather jacket. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel like picking up roses. There's never been such grave a matter as comparing our new brand name black sunglasses. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel as pretty as princes. The green autumn.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Susanna McCorkle singing a song by Irving Berlin. She took her life last month. Today in New York, friends and family will gather for a memorial.
Weary of roaming on, yearning to see the dawn, counting the hours till I can lay down my load. Weary, but I don't mind, knowing that soon I'll find peace and contentment at the end of the road. The way is long, the night is dark, but I don't mind, 'cause a happy lark will be singing at the end of the road. I can't go wrong, I must go right. I'll find my way, 'cause a guiding light will be shining at the end of the road. There may be thorns in my path, but I'll wear a smile.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, a work of fiction by David Schickler. And Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Steve Earle on writing songs and fiction. He's just published his first book, a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the new HBO series, 6 Feet Under.